I know. Politics, right? You can't not look, especially this weekend. But hey, give us a half an hour to make you smart on the economy, would you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 5th of October. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Well, that was a weekend full of news, was it not? Timing, of course, is everything. President Trump went to Walter Reed Friday after the markets closed. He took his motorcade tour yesterday before the futures market opened, and in between there has been chatter, but no substance, about Congress and the White House inching closer to another relief bill. And that gets us to a Monday that kind of looks like any other Monday in this crazy mixed-up year we're having. So we will continue about the economic news of the day. And our starting point is a holdover from the last relief bill, the Paycheck Protection Program. Millions of small businesses are banking on those loans being forgiven. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, just as happened when the program started, it ends in confusion.
Figuring out whether a business is eligible for full forgiveness, partial forgiveness, or none at all can be complicated. Mark Fryer owns three restaurants in Vermont. He says how much forgiveness he receives will help determine whether his business can survive.
And that's the most terrifying part, is we want to do everything we can to try to turn this into full forgiveness and not end up with debt, especially not knowing if we're even going to survive this.
Fryer hasn't applied yet. He says he's waiting to see if Congress decides to automatically forgive loans under a certain amount.
Of course, that would be something we'd want to make sure we wait and hopefully line up with.
Some borrowers haven't even been able to apply for forgiveness. Jackie London runs a public health consultancy in Colorado. She says her lender hasn't opened the portal it uses for forgiveness applications. Every time she sees a new email from her lender,
I pretty much just drop everything I'm doing. I go and I check to see, you know, is the portal open yet? Oh, it's not. Okay.
Just in case her $15,000 loan isn't forgiven, she's making sure that she has that amount set aside. London says she'd like to be able to spend it, but
can I actually spend it without that feeling in the bottom of my stomach of uneasiness? Is this mine or am I going to have to give it back?
It's been months since Virginia-based jewelry store owner Sophie Blake spent her PPP money. To control costs, she's been trying to renegotiate her rent.
We're just asking for some sort of financial relief because we were closed for 3 months, and that really impacted our business.
Blake says she'll send in her forgiveness application within the next 2 weeks. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
So let's say your business depends entirely, and I mean entirely, on somebody else being willing to share their product with you. That is the case for a lot of businesses, of course. The one of proximate concern, though, for us today are movie theater chains, which have been struggling to start back up. Over the weekend, Cineworld, which Americans know as Regal Cinemas, announced it is closing its theaters here and in the UK. The company says it's temporary, but without enough or really any blockbuster movies to show, and with once again rising infection rates, how might that temporary thing work? Marketplace's Jasmine Garz is on that one.
You could call it a chronicle of a death foretold. For months now, there's been warning signs that many theaters will have to shut down. The anti-hero in this story? Bond. James Bond.
We all have our secrets. We just didn't get to yours yet.
And we won't be getting to it until next year. On Friday, MGM announced the release of Bond's new movie is being postponed till 2021. That was pretty much the last standing big blockbuster for this year. Shortly after, Cineworld announced temporary closures in the UK and the US. That's 40,000 jobs at risk in the US. Professor Michelle Greenwald from Columbia Business School says the theater closures will also hit nearby coffee shops, restaurants, ice cream parlors, all likely to suffer if screens stay dark.
It's clearly going to have a domino effect. So it's, you know, bringing people to malls where people are spending money, bringing people to Main Street where people are spending money. And I don't even think that's being counted into the economic impact.
And with Cineworld closing its Regal theaters here in the U.S., other theater chains may soon close too, says USC professor Gene Delvecchio.
So without content and being so dependent on content, it was simply a matter of time that the theaters were going to run into trouble. And there's no light at the end of the tunnel.
But while things are looking bleak for cinemas, he says Hollywood could be just fine without them. Premiering on streaming services, like Disney did with Mulan, is paying off so far during the pandemic.
You're a war hero. You've already made many great sacrifices.
Straight-to-video used to be almost an insult. These days, it might just be the only way to do business. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but Wall Street sure does seem like it's over that whole pandemic thing, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not to be forgotten, given, you know, everything, is that millions of high school seniors and their parents are hip deep in the college application process. This is not, though, an ordinary year for those applications. That is true, but schools got to stay in business, because a business it is. Jeff Salingo spent time following both students and admissions officers for his latest book. It's called Who Gets In and Why. Jeff, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Used to be in this country, and you write this in the book, that, you know, like in the 1950s, you applied to college after you graduated high school, you got in, usually to the college of your choice. Now, that's different. And I want to know why it has gotten so much more complicated.
Mainly because students are applying to so many more colleges. So when I applied to college in the early 1990s, only about 1 in 10 students applied to 7 colleges. Today, now 1 in 3 students apply to 7 or more places. And so mainly that's because colleges have been flooding the market with marketing and direct marketing over the last 40 years, because they felt that if they got more applications, they could reject more of those students and look more selective to students because they kept the size of their freshman class essentially the same.
And there is, in fact, one guy. His name is Bill Royal. You're writing this book. He basically came up with college advertising as we know it. What is his story?
So Bill Royal owned a direct marketing firm in Richmond, Virginia, and it was really focused on politics and nonprofits. But in 1988, the admissions director of Hampton Sidney College in Virginia hired him to start doing marketing for them. And what he really did was try to flood the market with mailings to gin up interest that really changed the way that colleges had direct marketed to students, including sending to sophomores and juniors and not just seniors.
Okay, so look, setting aside cost, right, because that is going up at the top-notch universities, and yes, not everybody pays full freight, but look, sticker prices have sticker shock. So setting aside that for a second, although I'm not sure why I'm setting it aside. So let's look at it writ large. Do you think the system of higher education in this country is sustainable? I mean, you've spent a year plus looking at this.
I don't think it's sustainable at the cost that it is right now and the price that it is. And I think that parents and students are really worried that higher education has become the gatekeeper to the job market. And so they feel like they're forced to pay these prices. And they're not always quite sure what they're getting in return, particularly if they're going to get a job in return.
Do you imagine, and you know, your reporting for this book was done before the pandemic, or most of it anyway, but do you imagine the coronavirus changes higher education and how we approach it?
I think it's going to change admissions in a big way in terms of particularly around the SAT and the ACT. Mm-hmm. So 400-plus colleges have gone test optional. I also think we're going to see a number of colleges merge or go out of business in the next couple of years. And so I think that students will be much more focused on what they want to get out of education and whether they can get a job from their major.
I was going to ask you what you think the prospects for institutional change are, but that involves schools that have resources and power and influence giving up some of those resources and power and influence. And I wonder how likely you think that is. I mean, look, if Harvard turned things upside down tomorrow, then that would change things, right?
Because everybody follows Harvard.
Right.
Yeah. And I think really what is going to happen coming out of this is that colleges lower in the pecking order of higher education are going to have to come up with new ways of getting through the process. Maybe it's not a 4-year degree. Maybe it's a 3-year degree. There's just not enough students to go around to fill all these seats in higher education. And differentiation is going to have to be the name of the game.
Jeff Salingo, his latest book is called Who Gets In and Why? It's a Year Inside College Admissions. Jeff, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
We've got an excerpt of Jeff's book, a look behind the admissions scene at my alma mater, full disclosure, Emory University, into which I could not get today. You can find it at marketplace.org. Even in non-pandemic times, workers have certain protections while they're on the job. There's a whole federal law for that. It's called the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which in turn created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Left out, though, in times pandemic and non from that law's protections are domestic workers. And a California bill that would have covered them has been vetoed by the governor out here. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the story.
The bill would have laid out new safety regulations for hundreds of thousands of house cleaners, nannies, and elder care workers in the state. After Governor Gavin Newsom's veto, dozens of domestic workers gathered in front of a state building in Los Angeles Thursday to protest the reversal.
Is this what you want, Governor Newsom? Is this what you want to see? Domestic workers suffering and dying slowly?
The California Domestic Workers Coalition has long fought to gain protections for people exposed to harsh cleaning chemicals, hazardous wildfire debris, or who suffer injury from repetitive physical tasks. Organizer Megan Ortiz says the pandemic has exacerbated the dangers.
We've heard a number of cases, unfortunately, of women exposed to COVID in the homes that they clean and bringing it back home to their families.
Domestic workers are overwhelmingly women, the majority women of color. They're paid lower than average wages, and most get no sick time, unemployment, health insurance, or the right to organize, says Julia Wolf with the Economic Policy Institute.
It's really difficult to think of a more vulnerable workforce, I would say.
Governor Newsom said requiring private households to take on employer obligations for safety would be onerous and that enforcement would be impossible. But Debbie Berkowitz with the National Employment Law Project says more can be done.
We need to really figure out a way to get information to household employers on some of the key and critical hazards these workers face.
She says standardized training materials or guidelines on protective equipment would go a long way. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Hey, do me a favor and check out the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow and every weekday. David Brancaccio and the gang that gets out of bed real, real early to set you up for your economic day. Coming up.
I always joke and say I sell a product I personally can't afford.
Laughing all the way to the bank. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here you go. As predicted, Dow Industrial's up 465 points today, 1.6%, 28,148. The NASDAQ up 257, that's 2.3%, 11,332. The S&P 500 up as well, 60 points, 1.7%, 34.8. There. Regeneron, the company making that experimental antibody therapy that President Trump's doctors are using to treat him, jumped a little bit more than 6% today. And because, as you heard Jasmine saying, coming attractions are probably not coming soon to a theater near you, Netflix up 3.4% today. Disney picked up a little bit more than 0.5%. Away from Wall Street, depending on where you live, Main Street outlook is not so great. Data shows nearly half of small businesses in San Francisco and New Orleans are still not open for business. That's about twice the national rates. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are some virus hotspots popping up in New York City, as you probably heard. Mayor Bill de Blasio wants to shut down schools and restaurants and non-essential businesses in those zip codes. The governor of New York, though, said you can shut some of them down, just not as much as you want. They will talk their way through that, I suppose. But we are going to talk about a New York City institution that never opened back up in the first place. Broadway shut down in mid-March and is closed until at least early January next year. So we have gotten Eva Price back on the phone. She's the Tony Award-winning producer behind the revival of Oklahoma and a bunch of other things as well. Eva, it's really good to talk to you again.
It's been a year since we first met, Kai, I think about you often.
I was thinking the other day it's going to be a while before I get back to New York City. all right, so look, what are you doing with yourself since you can't actually be producing stuff right now?
I and everyone in my industry is busier than ever. It's really crazy. I know. There's just a lot to do. People are finding ways to create right now. You've got, performers writing and releasing their first albums. Costume shops are making PPE. Stagehands are building houses. I'm creating other ways of telling stories through other mediums for theater. And I'm still producing my big Broadway musical. It's just taken a few minutes until we get back on Broadway.
Let's get the plug in here, right? It's Jagged Little Pill, Alanis Morissette stuff. And it had, had it just opened when things shut down, or you guys were just getting going, right?
We opened December 5th, yeah, and things shut down March 12th. Yeah. We were 3 months in, and we have a group of really active and, engaged artists who are taking this campaign season very seriously. They're getting out the vote. We're keeping busy with that. And I did the predictable thing, and I even started a podcast.
Well, welcome aboard. Welcome aboard. let's talk about actually the whole campaign season, and not the politics of it, but economic relief for Broadway and the performing arts. You are working on that hard too, right?
Absolutely. I'm part of the executive committee at the Broadway League, which is our trade association. They're working really hard. Mm-hmm. They're in touch with all our government officials, and we're part of the Heroes Act. So the Save Our Stages bill is now a thing that we're working hard to try and make happen as a reality.
How hopeful are you? You follow the negotiation news as closely as anybody, I'm sure, and they're like barely talking on the phone, Pelosi and Mnuchin.
I'm not hopeful of anything, Kai. Yeah. I'm an optimistic person who sees the positivity and the glasses full. And today I'm sitting here, jingling my ice. My glass is so empty. Mm-hmm. It's rough out there. It's hard to stay hopeful of all the things that we need to get live theater back. Broadway was the first to shut. Yeah. We'll be the last to come back. And I'm hopeful that support can come from our leaders. Broadway is the beating heart of New York City. The city is the beating heart of America. And to not have live entertainment, it's hard to understand how this country will feel normal and feel alive again.
I'm not going to ask you to prognosticate on when that might be, because it is, of course, unknowable. I am curious, though, as to what kind of planning you're doing, because at some point you're going to get some indicators and then the governor's going to say go, and you're going to want to be ready.
Absolutely. I'm worried right now and working right now to keeping the mental health of my company strong and intact. I'm bringing opportunities for them outside of the live theater space. These are people who are like Olympic athletes. They were rearing and ready and going every night. So I'm working on that and preparing for the moment we are ready to go by making sure that everyone's head is and heart is in the game and ready to do it. And that's the thing that I worry about each day, because I can't read a tea leaf and tell you when our day is. I just know that we can work hard to be prepared for when our day is.
Eva Price. She produces stuff on Broadway. Lots of good stuff. Eva, thanks
a
lot.
She did.
Well, you did, and you will again. You will again.
She will. She certainly will. Yeah. Thanks, Kai.
Talk to you soon.
It's great to talk to you.
We've been talking a lot on this program about businesses that have been hit hard by the pandemic. Bars and restaurants and airlines, you all know the list as well as I do. Also, been talking about businesses that have managed to thrive. A couple of big names come immediately to mind. Amazon, Walmart, Target. Not talked about quite as much, though. A whole slice of this economy that is doing just fine, thank you very much. The high end, the very high end. Marketplace's Nova Sappho went luxury watch shopping.
The second time around shop in Beverly Hills is aptly named. It sells vintage wristwatches.
This business was started by a third generation watchmaker slash jeweler. I purchased the business from him in 2013.
That's John Goldfarb. He used to be a mid-level executive in the auto industry. He likes this career better. Goldfarb's store is well known among vintage watch aficionados, partly because in the back, just like at an auto dealership, he can repair and service what he sells. Goldfarb employs watchmakers, such as Kit Mock, who can fix pretty much any vintage timepiece.
He's listening to the beats, and he can tell by the sound and the pattern what needs to be done and what, you know, just...
It almost looks like a watch EKG.
It is. It's called a vibrograph.
The vibrograph, which looks straight out of the 1950s, is the most high-tech thing here. There are dozens of watches on queue for repair before they're sold, and they're flying off the shelves almost as soon as they're fixed. Price tags run anywhere from $600 for a 1970s Vitnauer to $26,000 for a 1960s Universal Genève. No, I never heard of those brands before either.
I always joke and say I sell a product I personally can't afford, but I think a good percentage of our customer base has a lot of income and are always going to have that income regardless of the economy.
And that's what's helped the luxury watch business endure the pandemic better than some other retailers. Demand for luxury watches, mostly Swiss-made, dipped right after lockdowns in March but recovered quickly. According to the Federation of the Swiss Watch Industry, exports of watches costing more than $3,000 are now basically back to where they were last year. Reginald Brack is a watch industry analyst at the MPD Group.
The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, meaning that luxury segment is doing extremely well, that 3,000 plus, and it's actually had a twice as fast of a recovery as the remaining market.
Luxury brands have taken note. With brick-and-mortar stores closed over the summer, some have relied on splashy, Apple-like product unveilings on YouTube, Instagram, and elsewhere. Content aimed at watch enthusiasts like Paul Bragan of Washington, D.C., who's been stuck at home and consuming lots of watch-related content online.
In March and April, when I was talking to other collector friends, we'd ask each other, what rabbit hole are you down these last few days?
Bragan, who calls his watches mechanical art, is a senior partner at a consumer research firm. He's still working when a lot of Americans aren't, but he's still being careful about his watch budget, employing a strategy that might sound familiar to other types of collectors.
I've been fairly lucky that I've been able to reasonably well anticipate something that might be more popular in the next few years and buy that piece and actually have it appreciate in value.
Then sell and use the profits to buy another watch. Collectors are increasingly doing this online at retailers such as Watchbox, a company that saw 25% earnings growth in the first half of this year. Mike Manjos, who's in charge of trading at Watchbox, says the pandemic accelerated an online shift for luxury watch retailers, and that's helping brands too.
The market's expanding beyond kind of those super well-known brands because they can get exposure on the internet.
Manjos thinks post-pandemic, the industry will not revert completely back to its brick-and-mortar ways.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
And even at the second time-around shop, owner John Goldfarb says his shop's website and Instagram account are bringing in customers, making up for lost street traffic around his store in Beverly Hills.
A lot of people found us through our online stuff, but they want to physically touch and feel the watch.
In order to fully appreciate that fine piece of mechanical art. In Los Angeles, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I'm just going to mention it real quick because you ought to know there is no value judgment stated or implied here, especially deep in a pandemic as we are now. Late last week, the national debt topped $27 trillion for the first time. Remember, debt is the sum total of all that we collectively owe. The deficit is the annual shortfall. Is that a lot of money? Yes. Is it to be unduly worried about right now? No, because this economy is still stuck in a very real way, and also interest rates are still real low for now. All right, we got to go. Not without, though, your Monday dose of economic context. When is it going to stop edition? No, not the politics, the economic damage. The National Association for Business Economics has published a survey of when the experts think gross domestic product, which is basically the economy, is going to get back to where it was at the beginning of the year. 38% said by the second half of next year, 32% said by the first half of 2022, 30% said by the second half of 2022, so toss up, right? Andy Corbin, Ali Famri, Ahan Horst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser do daily production. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.